Josephine Pierce, Rio 2.
First of all, after your English medical training, you became a nanny. I understand.
And there's the Munich crisis.
Yes. You, in fact, were evacuated.
Yes.
Why don't we start there?
But are you interested in that because it's above stairs and downstairs?
Well, yes, because...
Has anything to do with
the war
museum?
It does have to do with the war because you were evacuated. How, in fact, did you first learn what was going to happen to you?
Well, you see, the thing is on, is it?
Yes, that's all right.
The baby's mother knew Sir Archibald Sitwell, who owned Burford Priory in Oxfordshire. And they invited her to bring David and I down. And she also had a friend in the same block of flats at Putney. They were Berry's electrical. Young Mr. Berry and his wife, and they had two little girls. And Jo was my friend, their nanny. We're both trained nurses. And I think I'd been down there about 2 weeks at Burford when they invited them to come too. But our going to Burford was quite sudden, really, because Mrs. H came in to me and said, you've heard about on the radio about this crisis, which we're trying to avert a world war. And we will avert one. It'll be averted, but we'd better get David out of London. And we've been invited down to Burford. So we got in the car, we packed up and got in the car, and the babe and I and she drove down to Burford. And it was the most extraordinary place, because I cannot tell you the number of bedrooms. There were very many bedrooms, and they all had their own bathrooms. It had a chapel attached to it. But the actual building was not the old priory. I think it had been built up through the ages. And the chapel, I think, had also been so renovated that you couldn't call it the original old chapel, though it was on the foundations. It was through from the drawing room. And, well, we arrived there, and I think there was a sort of excitement or mingled with a kind of fear, because people remembered the First World War and thought that all this was going to happen again in the same way, but that there would be direct bombing on London before anything else happened, and so... In a panic, these rich people got their children out of London, you see.
Did you think that was sensible or silly?
Well, at the time, I was a young girl, and I don't think I thought either way. We were just being evacuated, and we went to a lovely place where they didn't know what to do with me. I was neither below nor up, whereas... Mrs. H and I, we'd have meals together, and, you know, she'd come and sit with me, or I might go and sit with her. It was quite a different existence to the one at Burford, where they really literally had a servants' hall with a whole army of different ranks among the servants. Rather reminds me of upstairs, downstairs, though larger.
Though you, in a way, were between... The servants and
yes,
upstairs.
The family wouldn't have me eat with them.
Oh, no.
I had a beautiful double bedroom with its own marble bathroom. And as I said in the manuscript, it was lucky that he was a baby, and so I didn't have to worry about where he had his meals. But I sat solidly at first, solemnly, all by myself at a round table in a corner of the servants' hall. My dishes of vegetables and things were brought to me. I was sort of, you know, a little bit, I don't know whether I was supposed to be superior or what I was supposed to be, but certainly I couldn't sit at the table with them. Oh, no, they wouldn't have me. Cook one end, butler t'other. And I think it was one of the family, I can't remember. I think it was one of the family sat with wee David upstairs. And then Jo came with her two little girls. And then the problem started, because where were they to eat? It wasn't quite right going back to those sort of days when there were upstairs, downstairs, that those children should eat in the servants' hall. They should really have been eating with the family. But as they wouldn't have Joe or I eat with them, it was all very awkward.
Then, of course, the war didn't start.
No, then, to our great relief, was it Chamberlain, wasn't
yes.
it? Yes. Was supposed to have made peace. Though I really, in my own mind, looking back on it, and at the time, we thought that he was very optimistic. He was really playing into the hands of Hitler.
Even then you thought that?
Yes, even then. I remember saying to Mrs. H., well, surely he's giving Hitler more time to do a bit more damage. And she said, well, that's exactly what my husband thinks. Her husband was in Parliament. And which is exactly what did happen. He just gave him more time to arm.
What did you expect was going to happen? After you returned from Beaufort, there wasn't, in fact, any war.
Oh, we thought that was that. No war. You know, eventually we thought, well, he's given Hitler time, but on the other hand, we didn't think of war. At least, I don't think I did. Possibly he and she did, because he was much more in the know, being in the house. Well, then it did come, and I left them. I went on holiday, and on holiday I decided not to go back to them, that obviously there was going to be a war, and I wasn't going to just waste my time looking after a child that could be looked after by its mother.
So before you became involved in your nursing overseas, you had hardly an exciting episode. Rather,
evacuating the school
yes.
children.
How did you come to do that in the first place?
Well, I had a friend who was a teacher in the East End of London. And I think I had mentioned somewhere in the manuscript that Mummy dumped me in an orphanage. And that
yes.
was there. It was same nuns who ran the hostel where my friend was staying. And I was talking to Mildred, and she said, oh, we've got to evacuate these children. There's tremendous plans. And Mosley was rampaging up and down the East End, and there was a whole lot of ballyhoo going on down there. And it was obvious that there was going to be war at any time, and the children must be got out of London for safety, especially from the East End. Because dockyard land, you see.
Yes. When was this?
This was 39, was it not?
Yes. Was it, though, before the war was declared?
Oh, yes.
Would it have been the summer?
It was, because war was declared, I think, in September.
That's right.
It was declared while we were evacuated. And so she told her headmistress that I was free and had offered to help. And she said, of course, I couldn't be one of the staff, but that I could have my railway warrant return. Well, that was all that worried me, was to be able to get back to do something eventually
yes.
if war broke out. If, because we were still if. The evacuation was if. It was pretty certain. I don't like to go over, as I've written most of it, but you must ask me what you want to know about it. But it was quite incredible that I compare children of those days who had little to eat in the East End. Remember, they didn't even know what a tree looked like, or a blade of grass, or a butterfly. They literally knew nothing of that sort. Mildred used to bring things up from the country to show her children in class. And because their parents never even took them to the park. They never saw anything of beauty. But they had this tremendous Cockney sense of humour, which is something undescribable, it really is. It's inborn into them, the real Cockney. And it is a very special sense of humour.
Can you remember any particular incidents?
Well, I don't know whether I've mentioned it, but I do remember one incident. I believe it got into Punch, but it was actually in Miller's class. She was asking for double numbers round the class. If somebody said 23, she wrote 32 down, and so on the blackboard round the class. The most minute little Cockney, wizened, ill-fed, whose nose just about reached the top of the desk, lifts his head up and he says, 33, see if you can mop that one about. And that was the real Cockney, you know. Always thinking things out, a great intelligence, but with the humour behind it, because though he was being very intelligent about this thing and the whole class had let her go on and had done nothing about it, he'd seen it, but he had a wicked twinkle in his eye, she said, when he said it. 33, see if you can muck that one about. And that was the sort of thing, and all on the journey down. Remember, these children had been got up before dawn. It was still dark. They didn't have cars or buses. They had been walked by their parents through various streets in the East End to get to this particular school. Some of them an awful long walk at that hour of the day, and it wasn't very warm. It was, what was it, September? And they brought their tiny little brothers and sisters, and they walked too, toddled along, some carried by mum. I cannot imagine the well-fed, comparatively luxurious living modern child being able to do it.
What was the attitude of the East End parents towards the evacuation?
They hated parting with their brats, as they called them. But there was no emotion. I don't remember tears. There was a grim, it's got to be done. And so they chivvied they were not gentle to their children, you know. They chivvied them along. And it had to be done, and so that was that. But what wasn't understood on the other end was that these children were more used to beer and kippers than anything else. That was their favourite staple diet, if they could get hold of it. Kippers were very cheap. And all that had to be considered and was not thought out beforehand, which is a very much a British tray. It is a tray of ours that we win in the end, but we don't seem to work things out and plan them out sufficiently. Because had they thought for one moment the other end of the difference, children living in slums, which they kept clean in their own way, never seeing greenery or beauty, never having been even in a train or a bus or a tram half the time, coming down into the country where everything was totally different, I think should have been thought of. Food, everything was so alien to them. And, of course, to the people they were going to the children they were going to live with, to the parents they were going to live with. but when we got them there, I think I've described the arrival. There again, you see, lack of thought, lack of planning, pelting with rain. And you leave them standing out in the open whilst you've got a series of great big sharabangs standing there empty. Well, why not bung them in the sharabangs, take them to this hall where they were going to get a meal, and sort the thing out there? No, they mustn't get into the sharabangs, but I'm afraid I wasn't a teacher and I wasn't going to knuckle down under that. Everybody was soaking wet and so was I anyway. And I just shouted out everybody in the buses. And we got the headmistress, Miller and I, we got the headmistress to persuade them to do the sorting out in the hall. But you see, I think one of the horrors of this thing was that Mrs. B only wanted a girl. Mrs. A wanted a boy. So you put the sister in one house and the brother in the other, or you would if you'd been allowed to get away with it. Imagine the cruelty of it. These children had been travelling since before sunrise. They'd been on trains that they'd never been on in their lives before, half of them. They were suddenly removed from close-knit streets because the street was life. The street, as we called it in those days, was social. I mean, everybody knew everybody in the street. It was like a village, everybody knowing each other in the village. And there was no need for social services at all, because poor as they were, if Mr. Brown had to go into hospitals, if Mr. Brown's wife had to go into hospital, well, Mrs. Higgins across the way would shout out to Mrs. somebody or other and say, "I'll have the brats. And if you get her old man's dinner, you know." And everybody looked after everybody else, even if they hadn't been on speaking terms before that. There was a crisis, so everybody rallied round. And then there would be every excuse for a party in the street. Am I wandering off? No. There would be every excuse for party in the street. Trestle tables were put all down the street, borrowed from where, I don't know. And sheets got from goodness knows where, put on them. And parties would be had. All. Everybody putting their odd halfpenny in, their odd penny in, their odd farthings in. And there would be paper hats and crackers. And there would be a party for the kids, all. Every excuse, a coronation anniversary or, everything would be used. Well, you remove children from that atmosphere and suddenly dump them in the pouring rain in the country which they'd never seen in their lives. It was a pretty emotional thing, a pretty difficult thing for them to stomach.
After the first dreadful day or so, how did the children from this area get on in Gloucestershire?
Well, I borrowed a bicycle and I went round the various hamlets. I got the names of the hamlets that they were in from the vicar. And I found that most of the people who received them were good, ordinary country housewives, and they were good to them. In fact, they took them out and bought them clothes and bought them boots and shoes out of their own pockets. Because they only got 5 shillings for each child, you know, board and lodging, which was a bit more value in those days than it is nowadays, but for all that, that was all they got. And they didn't get that at first, of course. Things take time. But it was this question of parting brother and sister. You could not get it into their heads that they'd had this emotional upheaval, and then to suddenly take brother away from sister because you didn't want a boy and the other one wanted a girl. there was I had quite a struggle with one or two of the families. But as a whole, after the initial reception committee of rich people, which is what it was, the country people took them in, but they had great difficulty with them because, of course, they wanted kippers and beer. They didn't like all the other good food that was put before them. They thought it was muck. And there was a tremendous having to give more than they wouldn't give. It was a take more than a give. The country people had to take things as they found them, because the children were very tough Cockneys, and I want me kipper, I want me beer, you know, and don't know what this muck is, you know. And they were being given the best of food and milk and cream and things that they weren't used to at all.
I know that a lot of London parents brought their children back to London, took them away from evacuation. How long did your particular group stay in Gloucestershire?
Now, that I cannot tell you. I believe quite a while. You see, I was only there to help evacuate. And until the headmistress could get the nurse back again, the school nurse, I agreed to do what I could, going round the hamlets. But I wasn't needed, because these families were very good to the children and looked after them very well. I mean, they were obviously in better circumstances than they were used to once they got used to it. One or two of them were not happy, there was no doubt about that, and would never be happy, and were probably the type that the parents would eventually remove anyway. But as soon as... I remember I was standing on a rural bridge, of all places, admiring the trout, and I heard somebody's wireless through the one of their cottage windows, when Chamberlain was announcing that war was declared, that we were now at war with Germany. And the whole bottom fell out of one's life, you know. We really were at war. Something terrible was suddenly happening. So my one thought was, right, I've got my railway voucher, I'm back to London to see what I can do. Which I did, there and then. Got the first train back to London, got in touch with the headmistress and told her that and she thanked me for what I'd done. There wasn't anything more that I could do, really. And I went back to London, and I heard of something called the Civil Nursing Reserve. And one flocked into this thing, and it's rather amusing, actually. I was suddenly called up to the Grosvenor Hotel, not the posh Grosvenor Hotel, the Victoria Station one, all mysterious. And I was staying with my mother at the time. Somehow or other we got together. I can't tell you how or why or where. Anyway, she was living in London and I'd spent the night there. This thing came through to report at the Grosvenor Hotel, Victoria Station, immediately, with one overnight bag. And I said, oh, good, I'm off to France. So we arrived at this place. Nobody was expecting us anyway. They wondered what we were. And there were about 10 of us sort of milling round. And we landed up on a goods train at Good Mays in Essex, which we had to clean and scrub and turn into an ambulance train. That was the wildly exciting moment of going to France. So we spent weeks and days scrubbing the train and making it suitable for an ambulance train. We were exceedingly bored, and our lady doctor was a Red Cross doctor, Dr. Crawford. She got the OBE after the war. She thought of all sorts of things to keep us amused, and she did a tremendous amount of drill, which we loathed. However, it kept us occupied. And we scrubbed that train. No sooner had we got to the other end of it than we started scrubbing again from the other end, you know. And she'd buy us sacks of apples to keep us happy chewing apples. And we were in frightful digs around in various houses round Good Mays, where they didn't like having us, but they liked the 5 bob they got for us. And in freezing cold bedrooms. And there again, this sort of times have changed for the better in that. They wouldn't mix with us. So you'd get back to your cold bedroom. So most of us, in the end, we stayed on stretchers on the train at night rather than go back. But at weekends, we had to leave the train because it was removed to another siding. And they were given a little extra money to give us Sunday dinner.
Who did they think you were?
Well, they knew we were nurses on an ambulance train in a siding.
Did that make you somehow indecent?
I don't think so. I think they wondered what we were doing, wasting our time when there was a war on and we were stuck in a siding. Well, we did too. And then we had an Australian sister aboard, and she was offered the job of going to France with a voluntary unit, which was run by Mrs. Spears and Lady Hadfield, the armament man's wife. And Mrs. Spears, as I said in my manuscript, had run a frontline surgical unit in the previous World War. So she was experienced, and Lady Hadfield asked her if she would start another one up. So the Australian sister, whose name I'll call Smith because I simply cannot remember it, was offered the job, but she didn't want to go. And she put my name up.
How had they come to ask this Australian sister in the first place?
I think she met someone who knew someone, if you know what I mean. I can't remember anything more about that. I'm sorry my memory's so bad. And I went up and saw Mrs. Spears, and my French speaking, for I've no accent at all, you see, I'm bilingual, and my French training was just what was wanted. And she wanted only English nurses and American nurses. And that was an agreement with the French authorities. I didn't go out with the first batch because my application had gone through after they'd been equipped and sent over to France, you see. But I went a month later.
Can you describe Mrs. Spears?
I wonder if anybody living would take offence. My son might be. She had a squeaky voice. She didn't make much impression on me, excepting that there was dynamism in her. She was going to get this thing going, and it was obvious that she was the one person to do it. There was no doubt. One felt confidence. One did feel confidence in this little person. She was sharp, but fundamentally exceedingly kind, or she wouldn't be doing such a thing anyway, and very brave, exceedingly brave woman, because it wasn't an easy thing to do. Especially with very little money. Then Lady Hadfield came forward and she said that she would finance it, providing her name was used, so it was called the Hadfield Spears Unit.
Did Lady Hadfield provide the entire finance for the unit?
At that stage of the war, until we escaped from France, because she got left in France, yes, she financed it. You remember, her husband was great munitions man, and it may have salved conscience a bit to run such a unit, and the money was not lacking at all. So the whole thing was financed by Lady Hadfield, I think, and Mrs. Spears did all the organizing.
It was voluntary in that you chose to participate. Was it also voluntary in that you were not paid?
Yes. We were given pocket money for our needs. You know, the odd things like soap and the odd things. We were given just a little pocket money. but we didn't think of it for payment. We wanted to be up and doing. I don't think that ever entered into one's mind. Our expenses were paid, our uniform was paid for. She had it all made at Lily White's, which was a very posh shop. At least she had cloaks made for us and peaked caps. We wore our own personal uniforms from our various different hospitals, which we supplied and brought with us. It was later on in the war when we went to the Far East that we were equipped with a full uniform.